Sire Watch. Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale. Hour two at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
From Coney Island to the Sunset Strip, somebody's gonna make a happy trip tonight while the moon is bright. He's gonna have a bag of crazy toys to give the cronies of the girls and boys all day. Santa comes on day. You come a calling when the snow's the most, when all your cats are sleeping warm as toast, and you gonna flip when old Saint Nick lays a lick on a peppermint stick. You come a flying from a higher place, you fill the stocking by the fireplace, so you have a youth as
Yule, that's cool. The one and only Satchmo, Louis Armstrong. My first memories of music on a record player. My father, huge traditional Dixieland jazz fan, and my father had a collection of 78s, including Louis and virtually every early incantation of Satchmo's bands. The Hot Three, the Hot Five. I really should ask my next time I'm home in Connecticut if I ever get to see my father again. He had these fireproof style metal containers that the 78s were in. My father used to tell me stories, Sid Fernando standing by, and I don't know if this is something Sid will be aware of, but Sid loves music. There was a record store, apparently, in the basement of the Roosevelt Hotel that, was like the Strand bookstore is to books. This record shop was apparently just, an absolute, the source, the place to find rare recordings and obscure recordings. My father, who didn't grow up with a lot, and didn't have a lot of expendable income, but he said whenever he had a little spare money, he'd go to the Roosevelt Hotel to the record shop. I think if you handed a young person a 78 record, they'd look at you like you had two heads. They wouldn't know what a 33, a 45, and a 78 is. If you showed them those three settings, they'd look at you like you were in a space alien. Sid, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Right?
Records are back now.
I know. That's true. Yeah. The turntables.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's so funny. My generation, and I'm sure yours too. I mean, buying 33s, buying, going to the record store to get the little singles, the B-sides and.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're the same generation.
Yeah. Too funny. Well, I'm all over the place, to be honest, Sid. Today we're kind of bouncing around, and Ed Martin's going to join us later this hour to kind of follow up on this topic that Sue Finley in the TDN broached regarding the young man trying to become a jock agent. it's such a desirable profession. I'm sorry, Jack Agents. That was a low blow.
That story just took off, didn't it? I mean, I read it last night and texted Sue right away, and then of course I'm not on Twitter, so she told me it was just taking off on Twitter.
It struck a chord, and she came at it from an angle of an example of the industry not welcoming young people. I don't think that his age is what what's at issue here. It's more the mechanics of what the rules are involved. Ed Martin's going to flesh that out. He's the right guy to explain what's at issue here. People right away, talking about how insular the game is and so forth. I mean, I don't personally see that, and I don't necessarily agree with that. When it comes, I'll give an perfect example with your expertise. I sure get the sense, Sid, that people that get interested in the sport through pedigree and breeding, that the only evaluation of them comes from how knowledgeable they are. I see so many people and so many young people that have expressed an interest and waded into it. I mean, you over the years undoubtedly have had people write to you and ask about how do I get into the game and this is something I'd like to do.
It's so funny you should say that, because just a couple of weeks ago I got a letter from a young guy who, he's 27. He's got a degree in finance. He was working in finance, but 4 years ago he went to the Preakness and was actually probably listening to this because he says he listens to quote unquote Mr. Bick every day. Anyway, so he just got, really into the racing, yada, yada, yada. And, he wrote a letter, to me recently, which I was kind of struck by, that, he'd like to learn and, he's available to do anything, for free, in other words, like an intern, and so I actually took a bit of an interest in him, gave him a couple of lessons on pedigree over the phone, a couple of calls, and then I just gave him a project to do, and I gave that exact same project to someone in our company because I wanted to compare it, right? And so I'm just waiting for his results. But, so I've engaged him and, went over some stuff with him. And, he sounds like a real fast learner. But, I did tell him, he's got, this. I kind of gave him some guides on what he needs to learn and stuff like that. And he's very thirsty for knowledge.
Well, it as we've said over the years, there's so many different angles to draw people in to the game, and whether it's whether it's playing, whether it's as a horse player, whether it's as from the pedigree breeding side, there's just countless. There's so many fans that and players. That have gotten into the game, and then the directions. I mean, Bobby Frankel. Bobby Frankel's the best story there is on this topic. He literally came out of the grandstand, to become a trainer. How's that for a story?
And staying within that Brooklyn motif. How about the guy that bought Brooklyn Strong for $5,000.
Well, and that's, and we're going to head into that topic with you, and you know, had the conversation with Danny Velasquez on Monday. What a fun story. And he said Mark Schwartz was down at the sale, and Danny didn't travel because of, you know, COVID restrictions. That was kind of in the teeth of everything. And it comes up with this horse for a nickel. It's unbelievable.
It really is, especially when you put that into relief against the other New York bred, Varda, that won the Starlet, came out of the same sale. That one, New York bred by Distorted Humor, was a 700,000 two-year-old for Bayoma Corp. And this guy buys the one, probably maybe the cheapest in that sale, I don't know, for 5,000. And they both, New York bred, they both were graded stake traces, what, the same weekend.
Well, the New York bred storyline actually from the weekend was pretty crazy, because you had three winners. That Sharp Star as well wins the Gopher Wand, and it was pretty heady on that, you know, on that topic. I also, in terms of inexpensive purchases, I had the conversation too with Chris Hartman, and the filly that was actually a 7,000 purchase, but then it was a much more sizable RNA, but still, you know, the initial purchase price under 10,000, it's very encouraging, Sid, and you and I, you know, point these out on a regular basis. You know, talk about how important this is for Wicked Strong, who, you know, seems to be getting runners. You know, it's not flashy. He's not, he's not starting out like Leia Band, but, you know, feels like he's getting some effective horses.
Well, what happened with Strong, this is a horse that by hard spun, he won the Wood Memorial and placed in some big races. Went to stud at Spendthrift, where in his first crop, I think, you know, he actually wasn't the top 10 freshman sire list. And I think he had like 26 two-year-old winners in his first crop.
Yeah.
This colt is from, this gelding is from the second crop. So his first crop, he got a few stakes winners. But, you know, what happened, Steve, is, you know, unless you come up with something big, it's really tough. And so he had his second crop, and they're just two-year-olds now. So his first crop's only three. But it's a cutthroat game, and the horse has already been moved from Spencer to Pin Oak Lane, Dr. Bill Solomon's farm in Pennsylvania. And it's a big, he did have a large number of two-year-old winners from his first crop. That was quite promising. And now coming up with a graded stakes winner, it's huge. And, you know, it's funny how things work out, because the heavy favorite in the horse he beat in that race, 10 for 10, Son of Frosted, Frosted had just gotten his first graded stakes winner the weekend before. Imagine if the other horse had won, it would have been two graded stakes winners for Frosted, and there would have been some huge hype right there with the first crop of Frosted now late in the year, producing two graded stakes winners, you know, back-to-back weekends. And unfortunately for that horse, he lost the Nashua, where he was second to a New Jersey bred. And now he comes back in the Remsen and loses it to a New York bred. So that, it just shows you the vagaries of the game.
And I just pulled up the details, and looking at the rankings, it's pretty funny what a win like this does for Wicked Strong. I mean, and as you mentioned, he was ninth in the first on the first crop list last year, and now he's 13th on the second crop. But he would also be third in Pennsylvania and fourth overall in the Mid-Atlantic. And first graded stake winner, but he had two stake wins last year, and now he's got four. He's got three different stake winners that have won four stakes this year. So, he's getting, he's having success. He's going to be standing for $3,500 at
Pano. He's a very good-looking horse, too.
It looks just like Hardspun. He's built exactly like Hardspun.
Yeah, that's true. He's got that leg on him, too. Hardspun is a leggy Danzig, as opposed to Warfront, who's more of the typical Northern Dancer-ish build of the Danzig, Northern Dancer line. Hardspun has more leg to him.
He, Wicked Strong, out of the charismatic mare, that Moyne Abbey, I want to say Bill Lynn, right? Was it Bill Lynn, I think, bred Wicked Strong, if I'm not mistaken. I think so. I'll look that up. But because he sold, because Wicked Strong went through as a purchase, and then subsequently, I think Lynn, retained the next. What was that? What was the next one called? I'll have to pull up the dams because he. It's one of those weird dynamics when you sell one that becomes something, and then you feel like, oh, I should have campaigned that horse myself. It'll drive you crazy. What kind of mares? What kind of mares fit Wicked Strong?
Wicked Strong. Yeah. Well, this is a great mating. It's Wicked Strong is a Danzig line horse, and Medaglia d'Oro is a Sadler's Wells line horse, and so the cross here is a very successful Danzig Sadler as well, and of course the reverse is true as well. The dam herself had some form. She was stakes placed. I think she sold in 2012 for $37,000 as a broodmare with that stakes form. But and it's not that great, a female family recoup the cash is under the third dam. But I think that what you have is, you have that. It's a really good cross, and I don't know why this colt only made 5,000. He's been a 6,000 RNA yearling at OBS as well. He worked in 10 and 2. Varda, in comparison, had worked an eighth farther in 20 and 4 at the same sale, OBS April, like I said. But, 10 and 2, that's a nice work at these two-year-old sales. From what I've read, Schwartz said that there have been a couple of minor vet issues. Even so, I also read that after taking the source of $5,000, I don't know if your interview, Daniel Velasquez, mentioned it, but the guy offered him a 33% stake in the horse. So apparently the trainer has a 33% stake on a $5,000 price. It's a hell of a story. Of course, someone from Brooklyn, I like the name as well.
Yeah, the name is good, the Brooklyn Strong. And, this race, of course, the Remsen has come under, and the Demoiselle has come under plenty of, of scrutiny. And, the mile and the eighth for a two-year-old at the end of the season, essentially. And... I even asked, where do you go from here per se, because you don't want to back them up too much either. And horses that are successful going this distance at this time of year, we've seen that it's almost been a bit of a plateau in recent years. This race got a. This race, and you could tell right away, based on what happened later in the day with the fillies, with that Malathat and Milfay, that this was a fast race, and they both came back with 93 buyers. I mean, this puts them in pretty good stead going toward the start of the three-year-old year.
Whereas I think I saw you tweet that Varda on the other, opposite coast on the grade one got a 68 buyer.
68, and... people right away were scoffing and carrying on as if they didn't notice that the horse that looked like she was going to march down the stretch and win easily had pulled up.
Had low buyers. Yeah.
She would have been not so low that if she wins that starlet, Princess Noor we're talking about, she was coming off an 85 in the juvenile fillies. And 78, 79 in the Chandelier and the other start at Del Mar. So, let's assume that, she would have scored in that range. People are being very unfair. I mean, in terms of, this horse kind of inheriting, Varda kind of inheriting the win.
Right.
I mean, it sure looked like Princess Noor was going to, canter home.
Right, right, exactly.
So,
unfortunate for them. That was a $1 million horse, obviously.
Yeah.
But they got the grade one, at least on a record.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. A new outfit, too. Zidane Racing. For Miss Beth, that's for Princess Noor.
Yeah, exactly. And I just pulled up, I did just pull up Wicked Strong from the pedigree side. And it is Bill Lynn and the horse. It's funny, I thought that horse that he had, I thought he had kept that other good stake horse that Jimmy Jerkins had. Or was it Jimmy or was it the Jimmy Toner? Clunchia, that's made $350,000, the Sydney's Candy gelding. But he did not actually, he didn't keep that horse. I know that he has kept one of the, maybe he kept the fillies, because she did, Moyne Abbey did get Miss Monk, who's a blame filly, who won a race. And right now she's got an unraced two-year-old filly. By Bernardini, called Delgani, and there's an unnamed Arrogate filly actually this year. That's a yearling, and it appears that she was barren Moyne Abbey this year. She's also got to be getting up there a little bit. She's 18, Moyne Abbey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By Charismatic out of With Approval. Mayor Classic approval. How about let's talk about the wonderful result for Hill and Dale.
Sweeping.
How about that?
Yeah, that's really quite an amazing achievement to get the first three home. In a graded stakes race like that, and just shows you, what a sire he is.
Malfat, your winner, and Milfay, second, and they were, they were a little far removed from the third place finisher, that Malibu Curl, but. Let's talk a little bit about Malathat. I really have not had a chance other than talking about the result. This is Shadwell from a Stone Street breeding. This was a $1 million, 50,000 Keeneland yearling.
Yeah, I mean, out of an AP Indy mare, which is a great cross. It's an AP Indy mare, isn't it?
It is indeed that lovely Dreaming of Julia.
Right. And in fact, that's such a great cross, not only for Carolyn, but also for Distorted Humor. If you notice in the just as an aside, the New York Red, you mentioned the money in Philly Star, also out of an APND mayor, too. It was a big weekend for the APND mayors. But this one, of course, out of Dreaming of Julia, grade one winner who won the Frisette. You know, she's a dam of five foals, but only one winner. And still, you know, with that type of race record and this type of cross and with Curlin, you're going to get that type of price. You know, the second dam is Dream Rush, who is also a grade one winner, won the test. So, you know, it's up front, it's a really big family. There have been some really very good, fast horses in this pedigree, Steve. One of them, which is not even a graded stakes winner, is that a Medaglia d'Oro colt, Atreides, who won four out of five starts, and he's extremely fast. The half Dreaming of Julia. So, you know, it's a case here where, you know, there's really, you know, you get a top level APND grade one winner, and you know, Curlin combines with that, and you've now got $1 million yearling that's fulfilled that breeding, and you know, she's going to be a broodmare down the road. Obviously, she's got her race record coming, you know, 3-year-old season coming up, and you know, it's playing the high end of the game here. So, the complete opposite of what we were talking with Booker Strong,
right? That's what's so much fun about, you know, about the pedigree side, about the breeding side, and the game itself. I am going to make a note regarding Stone Street and this family, because you mentioned Atreides, who's, you know, by Medaglia d'Oro and has his own potential as a stallion, but Dream Pauline is a sister, the half sister of Dreaming of Julia, that people will recall. She apparently lost a foal, which is too bad. Medaglia d'Oro herself this year. However, they're breeding her back. She is due in the winter with a Curlin. So Barbara Behnke and the team basically using, you know, the same formula with these half sisters going to Curlin with Dream Pauline. So that you can tell the playbook. Right.
And of course, Curlin is their stallion. So it's, you know, the good mares would naturally fit him and go to him.
How many, Sid, out of curiosity, and I, this is a question I've got to get, I don't know if we're going to get, I'm going to try hard to get John on before the end of the year next week. Covers would Stone Street have in to Curlin in his book? What percentage would you guess?
You know, first off, John's told me that, you know, Barbara Behnke doesn't like to really breed more than 140 mares to her stallions in Curlin. So, you know, Barbara Behnke owns 80% of Curlin.
Right.
So, you know, the lion's share of those seasons are Stone Street, and what they don't use are, you know, what are being sold. So it's a, you know, very lucrative stallion for them, a $175,000 stud fee. The other 20% of the horse, of course, is owned by that partnership group, Elevage, which is Craig Burnett and his mom and John Sakura. And they're, remember, they went in and purchased that 20% from Midnight Cry Stables in the Sheriff's sale. took that over, and then John convinced Bob Bubanky with his material interest in the horse, his partnership's material interest in the horse, that they would, you know, it would be the best, you know, thing to move the horse from Lane's End to Hillendale, since they were also now owners of the horse as well. And John had set up a relationship with Bob Bubanky. He was standing, for example, McLean's Music, that Bob Bubanky had bought back, Stone Street had bought back for something like $950,000from the sale, raced at that one race, memorable race, where he won huge in a freak time, freak buyer. Didn't run again, so he stood, fit the profile, really, a type of horse that John, you know, has done well with. And he got that horse, stood him at Hillendale from his first crop, McLean's Music, that is. He got Crowd Computing, a Preakness winner. John is also, John also stands Cantheros for Barbara Bankey, brought back up from Florida, and now he's standing for $30,000 over there. His first 2-year-olds conceived in Kentucky, ran this year and did extremely well. John has built a great relationship with Stone Street, and you know, it's paying off for him. He was able to, I guess, John started Medaglia d'Oro off, as we've mentioned on this show frequently. Stood his first season there the year Rachel Alexander was conceived from that first crop. But you know, John also lost to Lane's End Candy Ride that he started off as well for $10,000, which was a big loss for John. So in a stroke of poetic justice, he was able to get Curlin from the farm that had taken Candy Ride, Lane's End. He was able to get Curlin back, and of course Curlin has just turned into, John got Curlin at exactly the right time when Curlin was just heating up that year, with a bunch of horses running great at Saratoga. And I think that was the year Exaggerator was a 2-year-old, and then the following year, of course, Exaggerator won the Preakness, and everything just fit into place, and this horse's stud fee has gone up, and it's really established Hillendale at the highest echelon with Curlin, the standard bearer.
And just looking, I should actually look at Milfay as well, but just looking at Malathat and, the quality of this female family. You know, we talked about Dreaming of Julia. You mentioned Dream Rush. Then you go to Turbo Dream by Unbridled, Rev de Fee by Mr. Prospector, Rien de Ile by Nureyev, Rien Matilde, Vaguely Noble, Sir Gaylord got Gay Matilda, Hasty Road. It is a really strong tail female family.
It really is, and one of the Stone Street bred Dreaming of Julia, so you know this is a really personal type of mating for them. They purchased. I can't remember how they got the horse, but Hillendale had actually sold Dream Rush as a mare for $3.3 million. And from that, Stone Street was able to eventually get that mayor because Hillendale sold Green Rush to Halsey Minor. Remember him?
Sure.
Short-lived, yeah. short-lived in the game.
Yes.
And that was a $3.3 million sale. It's also a long history of John Secura with the family as well.
And you know what is? I mean, it's funny. You mentioned that. I'd forgotten about that purchase, the $3.3 million. But it's an interesting ascendancy that she had because she sold for $90,000 as a yearling at Keeneland. Then she sold for $285,000 as a 2-year-old in training. That's when West Point got her. And then after her race career was over, then she went out as a broodmare. And she, you know, she was a good racehorse. I mean, she made $750,000, won 8 of 16. You know, that included, just let me go back. I'm curious now, which I knew she had won. Yeah, she won the Prioress and the test back to back in July and August. And earlier, she had won the Old Hat during the winter and the Old Nassau County. Wow, she had won that too on Derby Day in 07. She was a really, really nice filly. And, we had some fun conversations. That was with Rick Violette had her at that juncture with West Point. And John, you know, I didn't realize this actually. John was, you're right. When you say the association, John was a partner with Lou Lakin and West Point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
How about that? Well, we'll be watching for her curling baby, as Barbara is clearly going to the well. And for those, you know, for those that heard those numbers that we talked about earlier, with the 140 covers times 175,000, essentially, curling is a $20 million a year producer for Stone Street, just for Stone Street, the 80% of that revenue. So for those that wonder why, you know, the making of a stallion on the racetrack is important, and it's not a question of, you know, of Stone Street and Barbara Banking needing the money, but it does pay for, you know, the way the business is operated. It pays for, you know, all the other horses that don't pan out.
And I mean that's the end goal for a lot of these. You know, the big money comes when you can really get a stallion, and not just the money, but if you're a breeder, you know, you're able to then utilize that horse. Whether it's curling with the Stone Street now, you go back, you know, Bold Ruler with the Phipps family and Claiborne. I mean, you know, that's how dynasties are really built.
Yeah. Well, I'll never. I think I used to be somebody that would kind of grouse when, you know, when a horse got taken off the track to, you know, to go into the shed, and we had Seth Merrow and I had Charlotte Weber on the show, and Charlotte explained, I thought very clearly, here's somebody who's one of the wealthiest people in the country. And she said, there's no way, I think this was around the time that To Honor and Serve and probably Brilliant Speed as well were going to stud. And I think I asked her on Loose on the Lead, I said about, you know, not coming back for another year of racing. And she said, you have to understand. She said, it doesn't matter how, you know, quote unquote wealthy, how much money somebody has. You can't just lose $5 million a year operating a large stable. She was, you can't justify it. Says, when you have the opportunity in the sport, and involving. She goes, I can go 0-for-30 with yearling purchases or whatever. I can, you know, it buys you the luxury of playing the game. I mean,
people run, no matter how wealthy people are, usually, you know, they run this as a business. And I think if you look at Judmont, you know, Judmont will sell horses to make sure that they stay in the black as an operation or close to it. I'm sure they're well above it. But, you know, they will, you know, they sold Empire Maker because they got an incredible price from Japan. This year, they had the first defense 3-year-old colt Siskin, who won the Irish Guineas for them. They sold him, the breeding rights while he was racing, and occasionally they're going to sell a horse that ends up being a tremendous stallion, as they did with Dano. So, you know, a lot of these operations, operate sometimes to people from the outside. They may seem kind of ruthless business decisions, but they're decisions based on keeping the rest of the operation afloat. And so, getting back to your point about Charlotte Weber, regardless of how wealthy she is, I'm sure, you know, nobody wants to be taking, $5-10 million in losses every year. It takes the enjoyment out of the game.
Exactly. You can't just hemorrhage. You can't just hemorrhage money. Essentially, I mean, that's the bottom line. These were the big 2-year-old stakes of the weekend, and we still have got a Futurity to run at Los Al, but we won't talk about that until we come back in 2021. So, kind of winding down. And
is this your last week before?
No, next week. Oh. Next week.
Okay.
All right, so get your you can prepare your Christmas message like a British monarch.
yeah. So we got next week, and then off. You're taking 2 weeks of
We're going to take
a well-deserved rest. Yeah, that's good.
I'm reaching for the wire, as they say. So I appreciate it. And again, we're going to remind everybody that, not only can you tie on and work with Sid, Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. I'm going to remind everybody again, if you've got a stallion that's entering service in 2021, you've got to get him involved into the system for the Enix hypothetical foals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Please enroll your new stallions, because what that does is it allows everybody to run free nicks for their mares against your stallion.
You'll be able to see what the pedigree looks like of your prospective foal. It's one of the really fun things, actually, to do. And then you look at it and you start to come up with hypothetical names for your hypothetical foal based on what you see on the page. Sid, thanks a lot. This was great.
Absolutely, Steve. And I'll talk to you next week.
You got it, Sid. Fernando, everybody, Sire Watch. You can follow, of course, on Twitter, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. Let's take a break here, and when we come back, Ed Martin's going to join us, and Ed's going to explain from a racing commissioner perspective what is involved in this topic that popped up yesterday based on Sue Finley writing about 23-year-old Phil Miller trying to become a jock agent. Ed Martin from RCI, when we come back at the races. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
The exciting Southern California Thoroughbred Daytime Racing Circuit continues with the LA County Fair meet at Los Alamitos Racecourse. The meet is off to a great start with strong fields throughout, and the stakes action continues at the Orange County track headed by the Los Alamitos Futurity on Saturday, December 19th. The Futurity has seen some tremendous winners in years past, like Standouts McKenzie in 2017, Improbable in 2018, and Thousand Words in 2019. Watch and wager on all the great racing action on TVG, plus all other major ADW providers at open satellite locations. On weekdays, our first post will be 1 p.m., while weekends will feature a 12:30 p.m. first post time. Plus, our wagering menu includes a pair of $1 pick fours, a traditional $2 pick six, and the popular 14% players pick five. And as we continue to follow our local guidelines, we'd like to thank all the great racing fans across the nation for their continued support of Los Alamitos Racecourse. Watch and wager on exciting Southern California thoroughbred racing. The LA County Fair Meet at Los Alamitos continues through Sunday, December 20th. For more, visit losalamitos.com.
With Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
I know you mistletoe, I want to get to know you. This Christmas, and as we trim the tree, how much fun it's going to be today. This Christmas, fireside is blazing bright. We're carrying.
There we go. We're starting to get into a nice flow with our Christmas music, as we always play at the races. Coming back after Sid, and happy to get an opportunity to talk to Ed Martin, Racing Commissioners International. Ed, good morning.
Hey, Steve, how's it going?
Not bad, and I appreciate the short notice to get you on. And as it happens, RCI. You know, in the headlines yesterday, of its own accord regarding the crop use and some amendment to those rules. I do want to talk about that. But, Ed, this story that popped up overnight, Sue Finley advocating for 23-year-old Phil Miller, who was rebuffed in his attempt to get licensed as a jock agent. And this is a topic that's come up on the show over the years. I cited Diane Voltz, who's been trying to get licensed to practition therapies on the backside in New York, and Tony Black, who addressed his own experience in Pennsylvania, trying to get into the stand after having been accredited by ROPE, the Racing Officials Accreditation Program, and they said, well, you need 6 months in the racing office to qualify. Ed, explain the background of this, these scenarios, and what is, you know, the motivation for these rules and how they differ around the country, and your thoughts in general.
Well, you know, I'll address the Phil Miller case a little bit, and I'm not familiar with the reasons why he was not allowed to proceed after discussing the matter with the state's NYRA steward Braulio Baez. So I'm not familiar with the specifics of this. The only thing I can tell you is the RCI model rules require that a jockey's agent have some degree of knowledge in the industry, have some degree of experience, background, and knowledge. And if it's the first time applying to be a jocks agent, there's going to be a written and oral examination. That's what we recommend. But we leave the determination
in the hands of the stewards or other commission designees. We anticipate that there'll be an oral interview or an oral examination, and then that will lead to a written examination. I have no idea what the specific reasons were why this gentleman was not allowed to proceed to a written exam. The only thing I could say is that if he's really wants to be a jocks agent in New York, you know, when you're denied something by a state agency, you have the ability to appeal. And, you know, if that were me and I felt that I qualified, I would pick up the phone and I'd call the next person up line. And there would be an internal discussion as to what happened here. And there may be valid reasons or there may not. I don't know. Well, the purpose of the rule is so you got people who are licensed for particular functions that, that have some degree of experience with the sport and can come in and kind of adapt and know what they're doing and not kind of mess things up. To me personally, I don't think a jocks agent has got to have experience training a horse or handling a horse. I mean, it's a different kind of function in the game. But that would be my comment on that, Steve. If the other option is, you know, if you can get a license in another jurisdiction and represent somebody in another jurisdiction, they give a lot of weight to that.
Right.
The RCI model rules are not mandatory. And it would seem to me that he might qualify under the RCI model rules as they are written. But if they've made them a little bit more stringent in New York, that's certainly their prerogative to do so.
Well, and in terms of the parameter, it's very similar to what Tony ran into in Pennsylvania. You know, there it said for him to submit, you know, his application, you know, to be considered for the stand, that he needed to have worked 6 months in the racing office. And in this particular case, the pre-qualification is having been licensed and acted as an exercise person, apprentice jockey, assistant trainer, or trainer, and in this or another jurisdiction for at least 1 year. And it really is germane that what amongst those experiences would necessarily, you know, make it any more likely that somebody would be a successful jock agent or have the knowledge and wherewithal. I mean, if somebody, to give you an example, Ed, if somebody came up in the racing office under these rules, let's say they worked in the racing office for that year, they wouldn't necessarily have qualified either, even though they have intimate knowledge of how entries are taken and how jocks get calls, etc.
Well, the only thing I can say with the New York thing is we urge everybody to adopt the RCI model rules pretty much as written or by reference. It is racing's... everybody talks about wanting to have a uniform rule book. We actually have a 500-page document that would be the model rules of racing that if everybody adopted it as written would be the uniform rule book. It already exists. It's a question of just making sure all aspects are adopted. I can't explain why that is the policy or continues to be the policy in New York, given the difference in the more flexibility in the under the RCI recommended rule. And I can't be critical of an employee of the commission who's enforcing the rule as written, but it would seem to me that if you think there's something that needs to be changed, you got to take it up line. And perhaps there's a way to continue to do that. I think there is, but he's got to do it. I can't second guess him or fix it for him. He's got to do it.
Well, and it's interesting in just kind of pulling up some, you know, some random rules from from different states, and maybe you can direct me on the RCI site. But for instance, in Delaware, it says this was an amendment to a rule, but each jockey agent shall obtain a license from the commission. Is this, obviously, this is a determination by jurisdiction. They can build whatever parameters they want into the licensing requirements?
No, they've got that right. I mean, the RCI model rule is ARCI 008-035, jockey agents. And it's pretty clear. It says you have to prove that you are representing at least one jockey that's licensed by the commission so that we know you're a jockey agent. And you must demonstrate to the stewards that you have a contract for agency with at least one jockey, that you be qualified as determined by the stewards or other commission designee by reason of experience, background, and knowledge. Now, that's a very broad statement, experience, right, background, and knowledge. A jockey's agent licensed from another jurisdiction may be accepted as evidence of experience and qualifications. So, in other words, if you're coming into a state from another state, you've got a jockey's agent license, that should be sufficient to prove that you're experienced and qualified. And even if you had that, they could give you a written exam or interview you in an oral exam. Now, if you've never been licensed as a jockey agent before, we recommend that all applicants be required to pass a written and oral examination. Now, the extent to which of what is discussed on that is up to each individual state. I don't know what happened in this particular case, if there was a discussion, if there was an oral interview, and at the end of that oral interview, the steward decided not to let him proceed to go to a written thing. I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows. I think the steward knows and maybe Mr. Miller knows. But if there was something said there that would demonstrate that maybe I'm not yet ready for prime time, then maybe the decision was the right one. But then again, if you're applying criteria that is so stringent and is not far more stringent than what's contained in the RCI model rules, we think it ought to be a judgment call, especially somebody who's been in the game and around the game.
Right.
Certainly, Mr. Miller appears to have been in and around the game. I mean, he was an owner. He's kind of was raised on the backside.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I could say about it, Steve. I mean, I can't say that I wasn't party to that conversation. I can't say that given the facts in this case, I would have decided the same thing. But, it is their call. But I would, if I were Mr. Miller, I would, and he felt that he ought to be given a shot, maybe they ought to revisit their criteria, you know.
No,
it's certainly far more stringent than it is in the model rule.
Well, and clearly this is a when it comes to the way the New York Gaming Commission and the way the stewards are applying these standards, it's obvious that they're more stringent per se than it seems other jurisdictions, because I think about Diane Voltz and her ongoing efforts to practice, alternative therapies.
I'm not familiar with the specifics of that case.
Sure.
The only thing I can say is, having sat years ago as the executive director of the New York Racing and Wagering Board, which is now the New York Gaming Commission,
right,
there are other state laws concerning the practice of veterinarian-like procedures that overlay what the Racing Commission is allowed to do. And I can't say whether she's caught up in some of that or not. That may be a matter that is totally beyond the authority of the New York Gaming Commission.
Because
I remember years ago, Steve, We looked at the concept of bringing equine massage therapists in on the backside to basically be licensed by the New York Racing and Wagering Board, and we ran into the laws governing the practice of veterinary medicine. And that kind of shut us down in our efforts to try to allow that. And that's, you know, that's when I was working there. That's over 15 years ago. But sometimes there are laws that govern things beyond racing that constrict you. For instance, a lot of people talk about out of competition testing. In some jurisdictions, under the current state, depending on the state, you may not have jurisdiction over that horse if that horse is not entered in a race or has not been entered in a race and is not on the grounds of a licensed facility. I mean, some of that's going to get fixed with the passage of the federal bill, but that has been that's been a legal thing that has stood in the way of a lot of things that people uniformly want to do.
I'm going to send out a link.
There's too many laws. There's too many laws.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. There's a lot of intricacies, and that's why, you know, that's why I reached out to you, Ed, because I knew you could at least provide, you know, an overwrap to help people understand, you know, where this is. I'm going to send out the link, you know, to the model rule document that Ed referenced, which is, you know, 450 pages plus, and I'm going to give everybody a chance. You can go right to the jockey agent section, you know, to see what, you know, how RCI has handled this, because this thing is obviously, you know, got some legs and is going to be either pursued or you know, is going to continue to be discussed. But I love the experience, background, and knowledge. EBK, we'll call it from now on.
Yeah.
As a criteria. That's that makes perfect sense.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, it's you know, without the constraints of a specific rule dictating otherwise, it would seem to me that Mr. Miller certainly meets that.
While we've got Ed, we're going to also visit a piece that came out yesterday about some added definition and restriction on crop use, Ed. Your thoughts on what was instituted and you know, where we stand when it comes to these, you know, jurisdiction by jurisdiction addressing how much, you know, crop use can be allowed these days.
Well, you know, the structure in the United States of the state regulation of this sport is that's kind of a given. That was the net result of how other forms of activity are regulated. It goes back to our founding fathers in this country. What we try to do is set standards that are will address that can be adopted uniformly, but the decision to adopt it rests with each individual commission. We've had quite a discussion because we're trying to get this right. And we believe we did. The discussion on the crop is the first people we asked about the existing crop policy were our regulatory veterinarians. And I said, listen, to what extent are horses coming off the track cut up as a result of the use of the crop? And it is extremely, and I mean extremely, rare.
Yeah.
And that's what our regulatory veterinarians have told us. So the issue that horses are being hurt out there is it's not what our vets, who are charged with the equine welfare responsibility, are telling us. Now, racing has an image problem. And the image problem is that we're not properly caring for our horses. And, of course, the use of the crop contributes to that. And the Jockey Club has done some significant research in that area. We actually have a webinar posted on our YouTube channel where this issue is debated from all sides, and it runs about an hour and a half, and anybody who really wants to get into it ought to go there and watch it. What we did several years ago is we changed the requirements of the crop to make it more humane to the horse, because prior to that, there were instances of horses coming back and cut up. But what we did is we put poppers on the end. So when you strike the horse, you hear a pop. So now the crop is louder than the previous crops were. But the crop is, if you were to whack me with a crop right now, Steve, I'd probably start laughing. It wouldn't hurt. I would laugh. Okay? But it's, you know, it's an image. And one of the images is that people are wailing, coming down the stretch, you know, using the crop, even though there have been restrictions in some areas. What we felt is we needed to clearly say that the use of the crop for urging should be limited. That you should not use it more than two times in a row. Now, some jurisdictions allow three. We thought two was the proper number. And we needed to clearly define what the chance to respond was. We always said you use the crop, but there needs to be a chance to respond. But we didn't define that. And we had a discussion as to what would help change the image and protect against the overuse of the crop, which is triggering a perception issue. So we define that as three full strides. So you definitely use the crop twice, three full strides, and then if you feel you need it again, you'd use it again. You know, and that will change how some jocks ride. We think that's a very doable and reasonable change. We think it will help the public perception. Now, you know, there are some people who believe using it at all is crossing the line. Well, if it's not hurting the horse, you know, that now becomes a perception and judgment thing. Now, the New Jersey Racing Commission has outlawed the use of the crop for urging, certainly within their rights to do that. And we are all looking to see how that works out. There are other jurisdictions around the world that have outlawed the use of the crop. There are organizations in racing, like the Jockey Club, who believe we should outlaw the use of the crop other than for emergency control purposes. These are incremental changes. Change the actual sport, because the public expects everyone to try their best effort to win a race.
Sure.
You know, that's why the jocks show the crop to the horse. You know, that sometimes is the motivation. If you give them a, you know, if you use it twice and, you know, there's an audible pop. The pop is probably worse than the. It's an audible. It's a stimulation, so that is potentially helping a horse to wake up come down. You know, give a better effort coming down. This has been a very tough issue. There's a number of people who've come up with. You know, the threshold issue is, do you allow the crop for urging? And there was almost universal support for that, with the exception of, say, the Jockey Club and some regulatory people. But most felt that it should be allowed for urging in a limited sense. Now, some people have come up with no more than six strikes in a race, or no more than 10 strikes in a race. We discussed that issue ad nauseum, and it's a Maryland and Delaware have adopted strike limitations in their rules, and it's worked well for them. In some jurisdictions, the lawyers believe that that's an arbitrary standard, and it's subject to, if you start citing people for a seventh strike as a violation, you've set an arbitrary standard that would probably be overturned. The concept of the overuse of the crop, we felt, at the end of the day, needed to be in the judgment of the stewards, because some races are longer than other races. And, you know, you're going to come up with a number. You know, we feel that our accredited stewards, we trust them to make the judgment call. And if, you know, upon review of tapes, that they're not calling out jocks that are abusing the crop, then that's something that maybe they shouldn't be in the stand. And so we took the position that we set guidelines, and the guidelines is basically that you should start taking a look at it if they did use the crop more than six times during the race. But we left the judgment as to whether it's a violation in the hands of the officials.
And you would hope... and this has come up as this discussion, you know, has grown. You really would like to think, Ed, that the stewards have enough proactive interest and involvement, you know, to have an ongoing, you know, dialogue with the jocks. And this is a topic that extends beyond the use of the crop. This also gets into the whole the herding problem that we've got, and you know, guys getting away with really egregious examples of particularly of herding, and not to mention the danger involved in it. And it just it does feel like you can file this under the category of stewarding that is not proactive enough, and that's something that's easy to solve if there's better communication, and if we kind of went back to film school and some of the things that that for years managed to keep these topics at bay.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why we several years ago started the Racing Officials Accreditation Program, and
right.
Why we've got these points of emphasis, and we make these stewards come in for continuing education every year.
Right.
That's raised the bar a bit. Like in anything in life, you're going to have somebody who's not as good as somebody else, and we need to call them on that, and that then also becomes a management issue for the individual racing commission. And if there's an official that the public or participants think is not doing his job, and I can understand why people wouldn't want to speak up, but those people are reviewed every year, and their job is not a given. You know, they get reappointed, and if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, then shame on all of us that they're still there. And we had that discussion at our board meeting last week. And if a steward is letting somebody abuse the crop repeatedly, it would seem to me if you don't call that person in, or if you don't sanction that person, based upon a gross violation or repeated violations, then maybe you shouldn't be in that job.
I've already gotten a couple of texts exactly in that same vein, agreeing with that sentiment. Ed.
Now, let me just say that sometimes somebody who's licensed and working at a track doesn't want to raise their head because the stewards, I'll tell you a story. When I first started at the New York Racing and Wagering Board, I came in, and you know, we had the thoroughbred stewards, and we had all the harness judges, the various harness tracks, and some of the harness judges felt that the track was their track, and they could do whatever the heck they wanted to do. And I remember we had a meeting of all the judges and so forth, and it was pretty much, you know, we're looking for uniform, you know, application of the rules. And, you know, we'd have these meetings, and everybody would ignore what I said. So then I decided one day, Steve, well, the heck with this, okay? The officials in the stand who got a little maybe too comfortable with everybody at a particular track, or we're not doing things or handling things fairly and so forth. Let's say, and I'm not gonna, I don't remember the specific instance, but let's say the crew in Buffalo would all of a sudden for 2 months get sent down to Yonkers, and the crew in Yonkers would go up to Batavia, and the crew in Batavia would go over to Vernon, and Vernon might go over to Buffalo. So I rotated them. It wasn't your track anymore. You have rules you needed to enforce, and they needed to be enforced, you know, consistently across the system.
Right.
Now, you know, that was a long time ago, and I get some pushback from the unions, but, you know, that's what you had to do. And, you know, and then, you know, it got to the point where everybody started doing it. But if somebody has an issue, with a particular jurisdiction, and they want to get it to the attention of the authorities in the jurisdiction, and they're afraid to bring it up, I will tell you that over the years, we at RCI have received inquiries like that from people. I'm not putting out a certain request for that, but our collective goal is to have the system work as best it can. And if somebody's doing something wrong, even if it's somebody, you know, who's abusing their authority or something, you know, if I know about it or we know about it, we can get the word to somebody and protect the source and just say, you've got a situation you may have to look into. And it may or may not get corrected, but what you really want is you wanted somebody to kind of look into it. And we do that. You know, we get those kind of requests from time to time, and we protect those people who do it. I'm not looking for people to come in and drop dimes on people, but, you know, if you feel you've got a situation that's really bad, you know, just info@arci.com, and it'll end up on my desk. And, you know, we're a small organization. We're a member-based organization. The network is large, but, you know, I do have the ability to call up an executive director and say, listen, I'm picking up this or that, and maybe it's something you need to look into. And more often than not, they do.
Ed, this was terrific, and I'm glad to, you know, connect on the fly to get you in here, and it's been too long since we've talked, and normally I would have seen you at, right now, actually. Normally we'd be at Arizona for a symposium, but I appreciate it greatly.
No sweat, Steve. I look forward to seeing you soon. Take care now.
Ed Martin, everybody, who's really spent his entire career taking care of these topics and addressing these topics. And I'm so glad we had a chance to, you know, kind of flesh this out. I've also sent the actual page of the jocks agent rules that he talked about. And, obviously they're different from the way New York has got this structured. And, you know, I'm going to add also a link to the 400-page document for people that have never looked at this kind of thing, so you can understand, you know, what the work is of RCI and how they're, you know, addressing these topics, all the topics that they have to in the terms of administering racing and paramutual product. Let's take a break. Andy's going to close out the morning, and we'll come right back and finish up on what's been a pretty full pretty full Wednesday. I just looked up. I saw it was 11:20. I got to get Andy in here and probably see if I can carry him to the top of the hour. Usually the egg timer goes off at about 27 minutes. And he's got a pretty good head. He's pretty good clock in his head, like a jockey. Back after this, Andy Serling.